Launching a book isn't easy, but it can also launch you into a whole new life.
What's important now is that I am a best-selling author, and that's awesome.
I found my soul on this journey. I found my purpose, you know, in life.
In this show, I talk to authors about how they launched and how it took them to the next level. Hi there, and welcome to episode 323 of Launchpad Pub. I'm your host, Anna David, and if you're new to the show, welcome. It's a, you know, I talk about launching a book, what a book can do for your career, the stuff we talked about in the intro, and I'm back. You may not have known I went away, but I had recorded those episodes that were my book excerpts and released them the last 3 weeks. Thank you for listening to those. If you didn't hear them because you're that new to the show, go back and listen to them. It's the excerpts from my audiobook of my most recent book, which is called Make Your Mess Your Memoir. So today I have a guest. It's somebody that I met when I lived in New York and hadn't spoken to really since I left New York. And he has a very interesting publishing story because he worked behind the scenes as an editor at, you know, Big Five publishers. Then he started writing on his own, had a great deal of success, as in over a million copies in print worldwide of his thrillers. And he's written different stuff. He wrote a children's adventure novel. He wrote an adventure novel for middle graders and then a children's picture book. So not only does he have an eclectic version of the books he's written, but then he has an eclectic career because then he went and started his own publishing company in 2013. And so we talk about that journey, and we also talk about what we got really into, which was a surprising diversion that I was very interested in, is how to get your book in libraries. Because that may sound really boring, and it can make a world of difference in terms of the success of your book. He also talks about his launch tips, which involve really building up a name through your expertise before your book comes out. So did I tell you his name? Jason Pinter. Here we go with Jason Pinter. So Jason, I was reflecting on when we met. Do you remember when it was?
I think it was through Andy Levy at Fox News, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. That I think you were a guest on Red Eye. And I think I was there because I was friends with Andy, who was one of the co-hosts. And I think you were there promoting a new book, if I'm not mistaken.
That part I don't remember.
Maybe it's a guest then.
No. You're right. I don't remember like what I was there doing, but I remember meeting you in between the green room and the hall.
Yes.
It was the hallway outside the green room. And I had thought that it was Greg, who basically, I just knew one of the Red Eye people was like a huge fan of your books.
Yeah.
And thus invited you to the show, but not to be on it, just to hang out?
It was weird, because Andy Levy, who we met through a mutual friend of ours, another writer named JT Ellison. Andy was a big fan of JT's, and JT's a friend of mine. And through JT, he read my books, liked my books, and we sort of became friends in a weird way. So he invited, and I liked the show, he invited me to check out the show, but again, not to be on the show, just to kind of like sit there and watch, which if having been on Red Eye, they don't really have a studio audience, so it was just sort of me sitting there.
Yeah, you should have been on. But
talk to Greg and Andy. That was my, I think over the years I sort of made a little like, hey, you know, I hang out with you guys enough. We go out and drink sometimes after the show. Like, invite me on. But I think like they only had authors who were like kind of, you know, big time on there, and I wasn't quite big time yet.
Okay, first of all, that's not true. They liked authors, female authors with good legs.
I have neither of those. I'm neither female nor good legs.
No. But I mean, I can't speak to your legs, but you're definitely not female. And they didn't care about males with good legs.
Checked the boxes off way more than I did.
Well, because they had something they called the leg chair.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You knew all about that stuff. Okay.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think that the press secretary of the United States sat in the leg chair quite frequently on that show.
Rest in peace, Red Eye.
Yeah.
a beloved show by some.
Yeah, by some.
Okay. So we met, and then we were going to work together on we were a little bit ahead of our time in a way. Mm-hmm. We wanted to put on a book event.
Yes.
And that never happened.
But we tried.
I think it was me, you, and Sherry Goldhagen, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, and it's sort of like we met at this coffee shop a few times. And I think we even like had a, I think we had a schedule we'd put together. And then for some reason, it never happened. I think maybe you moved out to LA, and we all just sort of got busy with whatever we get busy with.
Yes, that's exactly. You have a great memory. And so your history is extremely interesting to me because it's unlike most people's journey in publishing. You started out as an editor, or working your way up to be an editor at places like St. Martin's. Is that right?
Yeah. So my first job was at Warner Books back when it was Warner Books. Now it's part of the Grand Central Publishing, Hachette sort of conglomerate. So I started out as an editorial assistant at Warner Books, then got hired at Crown, which is a division of Random House, led to me getting hired at St. Martin's Press. I took a couple of years off to write full time, but then ended up in marketing and publicity at Grove Atlantic, which is sort of one of the larger independent presses, working for Morgan Entrekin, who's sort of like a publishing legend. And then while I was there, I wanted to start my own firm. So I think it was 2013, I launched Polis Books. And during all that, of course, I wrote my own books. And I have a new one called Hideaway that just came out in March. So it's sort of like been on both sides of the desk now for, God, like 15 years, 10, 15 years. I'm getting old, I forget.
You're way younger than me, I'll tell you that. And you're always going to be. So did you know when you started as an editorial assistant that you wanted to write your own books?
I think I did. I sort of got into the industry in a backwards way because I wanted to be a writer. So I remember this distinctly. I went to college at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and I had written a very terrible coming-of-age novel that I knew wouldn't get published, but I sort of I had no idea how to get a book published. I knew nothing about the industry. So I went to the head of the English department, and I basically said, like, how do you get a book published? And she said, well, you need a literary agent. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. I guess, like, actors need agents, musicians need agents. I guess I need an agent. So I queried a whole bunch of agents, basically saying nothing, saying, like, hey, would you like to represent me? And, of course, like, you know the industry, like, nobody even responded to me because I didn't know what I was doing. Right. But then I figured, like, if I'm going to figure out how the industry works, maybe I'll try to actually work inside of it. So I ended up getting an internship at this boutique literary agency, really got to know the industry there, loved the editorial side of it, and then ended up getting a job at Warner Books, basically fresh out of college. So I sort of got into publishing because I wanted to be a writer, but then ended up loving the publishing side still. I love the editorial process. I love working with writers. And I sort of always did want to do both. It was just sort of figuring out a way to make that happen.
And so you were working as an editor, and then you said you switched to marketing. Is that?
Yeah. So I was an editor at Crown and then St. Martin's Press. I then took a couple of years off to write full time. Then when I wanted to get back into the industry, Grove Atlantic was relaunching this imprint called Mysterious Press, and I sort of knew the thriller, mystery, crime fiction world backwards and forwards. So it was a job that was not only marketing plus, it was sort of being like the in-house editor too. So given that I'd written my own books and had spent a lot of time promoting and publicizing them, and I knew this community well, I figured it could sort of like harness my talents in terms of both the editorial side, and I knew the marketing publicity side well. So yeah, it was different in the sense that it was not editorial, but I still had those skills, marketing and publicity, that I'd gained from writing my own books, having to promote them.
And so since this podcast focuses on launches, let's talk about marketing and publicity from the traditional publishing perspective. My experience is that 99% of the writers you're working with are going to be angry at you because, and I've learned this really since leaving traditional publishing, because you are taught to only focus on the top 1%, the books that the company already knows is going to be successful. And what I didn't know at the time, but I've been told since, is that you guys, I'm going to stop saying that. People who work in publicity at book companies are basically told, like, not lie to those writers, but those writers are going to ask you why you're not doing anything, and you got to look like you are. And it doesn't mean anyone's a bad person. It means
that they know where their bread is buttered. And so it's going to be focusing on the people they already know are going to be successful, which is very unfair to these writers who don't know that. Sorry, it sounds like such an accusatory question, but you're not doing it anymore. So wait, is that true?
Yes and no. I mean, if you look at like St. Martin's Press, I was working on their Minotaur mystery line, and it's an enormous line, I want to say. And this, granted, this was probably 10 years ago when I was there, but they publish, I think, upwards of like maybe 100 books a year, and divided that into three seasons. It's like 30 to 40 books per season. Out of those 30 to 40 books per season, maybe five of those are really given a lot of marketing and publicity support, because those are the books that have essentially been deemed, you know, ones that have a better chance of breaking out. I don't quite know what rationale is used for those. Maybe it's a more commercial story. Maybe the author has a certain kind of platform. Maybe it's the next book in an already successful series. But the truth is only a certain amount of books really get significant marketing and publicity. That's not to say the other books are kind of left to drown. I mean, each book has their own publicist, their own marketing person. And if you're a young publicist and you're given a book that has very modest expectations and you can get it to work, that's a big feather in your cap. So, you know, so having a book that doesn't have a lot of resources behind it, people are still trying to make it work, but it might mean like you're not getting advertising in USA Today. You're not getting sent on a tour. You're not getting, tchotchkes made up and put into book bags all over the place. There are resources devoted towards certain books as opposed to others. And it generally is based on commercial viability, and that is such a nebulous term. And especially over the last year or two, when there's been an increasing push towards more diverse books, I think what was considered commercial then is very different from what's considered commercial now. And I think on the good side, there's been a more of a push towards extending what the term commercial viability means, that there are books that are much more quote unquote viable that maybe weren't considered such beforehand.
Yes. I mean, the unfortunate part, I think, is that, you know, a lot of the books that are not given that attention, these are the hopes and dreams have come true, you know, because they're the younger authors. And, oh my God, it's all going to happen for me. And I'm not saying it's the seasoned, bitter people that get all the attention, but it doesn't seem to mean as much. And they're going to get the attention regardless. But anyway.
It depends on the situation. I would just, whenever I'm on panels, people always say like, if you're a new author, what can you expect? And I say, first off, unless you got like $1 million advance, don't expect a book to change your life. Take pride in it. Do everything you can to help promote it. And always have your next book ready to go when that one comes out. Have your next step planned. But don't expect the book to hit the New York Times bestseller list. Don't expect to make enough to quit your job. Look at it as something that you work very hard on that is now going to hopefully find readers, and then to hopefully devise a strategy to grow your audience. But to say, like, if you've worked 3 years on a book and then you get a book deal, your world doesn't change automatically unless you're one of those, 1% of 1% who got a tremendous amount of money. Most people don't. The average advance is very, very low. And the reason you hear about people like Janine Cummings getting $1 million is because it doesn't happen very often. Right. So just be realistic about your expectations. But what I say, like, a book is permanent. Like, you've written a bunch of books. I've written a bunch of books. Like, those books are going to be on my shelf forever. And maybe I didn't buy a yacht from them, but at the same time, like, I'll be able to show them to my kids and their kids. And, like, you know, I can find myself online. And that's pretty cool. Like, I accomplished something. That's something you can always take with you.
Yeah, very, very true. I think it's all about expectations. But the majority of the people who listen to this are hopefully avoiding traditional publishing, because that is what I'm always preaching. I can't tell you the number of people I speak to who say, I want to go traditional because I want to go on a book tour. I want my book in stores. I want to go on the Times list. And, you know, what I've learned over the past decade is basically it's easier for me to get books in stores than it was for me to rely on my publisher to. I didn't know. Right. I just trusted them. And they'd be like, oh, your book's in Barnes & Noble for 2 weeks. And I thought, well, that's the best I can do. And now I can, have it in Ingram. And
ask people to go order the book from Barnes and Noble. And there's so many strategies that make me see how much better independent publishing or self-publishing is.
Yeah, it depends. I think you're smart enough in that you built a platform for yourself to the point where when you have a book come out, you have a large number of followers on Twitter or Instagram, you have a podcast, you're out there. So you can get people to buy your book. You have a number of people who are already probably looking forward to your book. The tricky thing is somebody who doesn't have that readership, somebody who either isn't on Twitter or has 12 followers, somebody who doesn't know how to use Facebook or Instagram. What I would say is like the distribution methods for publishing are night and day what they were 10 years ago. And you can do really well self-publishing, but if you expect to write a book, put it up on Amazon, and it's going to sell 50,000 copies, you're gravely mistaken. You got to think about a strategy. How are you going to reach those readers? Because it's not just having that page and telling your parents to spread the word. How are you going to drive people to your book? How are people going to know about it? Having a book available isn't the same as actually driving readers to it. But if you have a real strategy like you do, you can absolutely do that. And having a book available, like you said, through Ingram, it can be available in perpetuity as opposed to like that infamous sort of like you have 2 weeks and then you're gone.
Yeah. So what are some of the strategies that you would recommend?
Well, I think it depends on the type of book you're writing. So I write mysteries and thrillers, and I think 7 thrillers I've published, only one of them I've done myself, and that was a book called The Castle. And the reason I did it myself is because it was sort of a thriller loosely based on the 2016 election, about a young man who sort of ends up getting pulled into the candidacy of this upstart third-party candidate who's not unlike our current president. I did it myself because when I was my agent was going to shop it, but we decided that if it did sell, it wouldn't come out for a year and a half, at which point the news cycle is over. I felt it was timely enough that it needed to be out now. And if I did do it now, I could get a lot of publicity surrounding the topic, which was about politics and the election, which was in the front of everybody's, tip of everyone's tongue at that point, and it worked pretty well. So if you're writing fiction, you need to think about nonfiction angles for your book. If you're writing a book about a character who's obsessed with birding, approach bird watching sites. If you're writing a book about a romantic comedy, maybe you can approach dating sites and write blogs for them. If you're writing nonfiction, is a little easier in the sense that you're already essentially offering prescriptive advice for the most part. And you can approach places that offer prescriptive advice. If you're giving advice on starting a business, there are tons and tons of places of websites that like Entrepreneur or Financial Times, places that would want you to write content for. People are always in need of content. So you have to look at hooks for your book and think, what are people going to be interested in? Who can I write for? And then you just got to grind it out. You got to approach everybody, write pitch letters, like solicit everyone. One thing you cannot do is expect anybody to come to you. You have to hustle.
And so what would be your recommendation? I mean, it's a little bit easier said than done to get into Entrepreneur. With, a billion clips, how hard I had to work to get in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you recommend for someone who wants to break through to one of those big publications?
Well, I think you start small and then go big. Like if you start approaching the New York Times right away, unless you're an absolute genius, unless maybe you will, but there are plenty of great writers who don't get published for whatever reason. I think you start small and build up. You build a readership. It's not going to happen overnight. That's why I say if you're going to write a book and then if you want to self-publish it, don't self-publish it and then start the work of promoting. You want to start the work months in advance so that by the time the book is coming out in October, you're reaching out to people in June and July. You want to try to reach out to the long lead magazines. You want to reach out to the website so that when the book comes out, then you can have the pieces drop. And you can essentially start building up clips, building up a resume. It's very rare you can essentially go right to the top. Start with places that it will invite you. Maybe a friend runs a blog. Maybe somebody you know runs a website. And then just build up clips and hopefully you start to build up traction. Become an expert in something. If you're writing a nonfiction book, tell people why you are that person to write that book. So for your book, I mean, you've worked and you not only have written fiction, you've written a bunch of nonfiction, you've co-authored books, you've done podcasts. You can legitimately say you're an expert on certain topics. For somebody else who's writing a book, convince people why you're the expert on that topic. And if you're able to do that and build clips, then you can start to reach out to the bigger places and say, here are all the places I've been. You can see how popular they are, like, you know, and make sure you have your pitches ready too. But if you're going to publish a book, you want to start at least 3 to 4 months in advance, if not more.
Yeah, that's great advice. And you know, this is what I've been thinking about lately, because I've seen a lot of people be successful and not successful. And this goes for books as well as building a business. Mm-hmm. It's so bizarre. Yeah. You have to just basically have the confidence or fake the confidence to declare yourself a person worth listening to.
You're absolutely right.
And mm-hmm. and it's weird because some people, I have seen people's careers blow up in 2 years because they just decided that. And I have watched people, you know, flail around for 15 years because they never did that. You know, mm-hmm. the public has to find you interesting unless your book yes. is a massive hit out of the gate. And you have to make them find you interesting. And
right.
the first step is to just decide you are. Why not you? Anyone who's listening, why not you? We are all experts in something. So stick your, you know, stake in the ground and just say, I'm that person.
No, that's 100% right. You need to give people something to hold on to. Because just saying I have a book out does absolutely nothing. There are, you know, 500,000 books published nowadays. But you know, you watch TV and like, I don't know, I watch sometimes on the news. I'm like, I know more about certain things than these people do, but they're on TV and I'm not. So that's a big part of it. Just like, you know, becoming an expert on something, being able to talk about it in an authentic manner and just tell people how great you are. That sounds simple, but the truth is, like, you know, a lot of writers I think aren't built to self-promote, but you kind of have to be, especially if you're doing it yourself, because how else are people going to find out about you? If you tell people that you're great and your book backs it up, you're going to get more people to listen to you than if you just sort of like put it out there and wait for people to come to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about your transition into starting your own publishing company. Mm-hmm. So you decided to do that. At first, it was just ebooks, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it was originally digital only. But then basically what happened was we were getting in some really good books and I had a sales and distribution team behind me. And we had a lot of conversations and it was like, listen, we can get these books into stores. We can get some marketing and publicity for them. There's more money if you have a print component. It's certainly it costs a lot more, but we felt the upside outweighed the downside. And we did it fairly quickly. I think my goal was always to start digitally and move into print, but my goal was 3 years. I think we did it in about less than 18 months. And I'm glad I did it. We only released maybe 2 or 3 titles digital only, and we've basically been doing full-on print and digital distribution now for the past 6 years, I'd say.
And how many books do you release a year?
Between 20 and 30.
How big is your team?
It's me and one other editor / acquisitions editor. And then we have a team of marketing and sales reps. So I'd say overall, yeah. So we work with Publishers Group West. It was Publishers Group West. They were then purchased by Ingram. So now it's sort of like PGW/Ingram. So basically I have a team of sales reps that go out to all the different accounts, whether it's Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Baker & Taylor, different independent stores, libraries, Follett, and essentially pitch our books to them. And some books, they want some books they don't. So it's basically me and one other person, a woman named Chantel Osman, who runs our new Agora imprint. Then all these marketing and sales reps. Then we have sort of a rotating roster of freelancers who do everything from cover design to interior design to IT, and they come in on a case-by-case basis per book. So I'd say like overall maybe 25 people at any given moment, but only 2 are really like full-time with the company.
So you edit 30 books a year?
I do not edit 30 books a year. I'd say I edit maybe 10.
Okay.
I would say I edit 10, Chantel edits 10, and then we have a couple of freelancers who edit the other ones. There's just not enough time. I love editing, but it's a very time-consuming process, and I just don't have enough time in the day to edit every book on our list. I wouldn't have time for anything else.
That's why my mouth was agape.
Yeah, no, that would literally be impossible. I would die.
And so let me ask you, what is the difference between somebody, because anybody could upload a book onto Ingram, and what mm-hmm. your sales reps do? Does that mean your books are not print on demand the way a person who just uploaded to Ingram would be?
So we do both. The difference is that if you upload a book and make a book available through Ingram, it only ships from Ingram if somebody purchases it. For us, we have sales reps that go out to different accounts, like I said, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores, libraries, and essentially they present them with our catalog. So we have libraries order our books. We have independent bookstores order our books. So we do the majority of our printings are what's called offset, which means that we actually have a printer that prints our books, delivers them to our warehouse, which is in Jackson, Tennessee, and then all the different accounts that order books have them shipped from Jackson. But then we also make a lot of our books available, essentially print on demand through Lightning Source. Usually that's for smaller quantity books where it doesn't make sense to do them offset because the costs and production schedules are higher. So the majority of them are done offset, which is real through a real printing press. Then we do have some that are done essentially uploaded to Ingram through Lightning Source and available through there. But the idea is that the books are available not just in stores, but also available online at any point. So if you order it, you buy it. But we also have distribution into stores and libraries.
So when they pitch to Amazon, say, what does that mean? That Amazon isn't printing on demand the way they do other books. They have it in their warehouse.
That's exactly right.
And it's just the decision is really just financial because it's not like the book comes any quicker.
So basically what it is, if you're printing through Amazon, I think you're talking about CreateSpace,
which is it's now KDP. Oh,
it's KDP. So KDP is what CreateSpace was, which is basically print on demand, which means that your book is available on Amazon, and if I order a copy of it, it's going to come to me. What we do is we actually have our sales reps who pitch our books to Amazon, so that Amazon will say what they want to do is they want to make sure this book is going to sell. So we have this debut novel coming out next summer. Why is it going to sell? And so we said, we're going to have reviews running here. We're going to have interviews here. We're going to have an author profile here. That's going to drive readers to the book. So then Amazon will say, we want to take 100 books to store in our warehouse in the hopes that people will then order them from us. And if Amazon then buys those 100 books, that means they pay us for those 100 books as opposed to only paying one at a time per order. So again, it sort of increases the upside for us. And additionally, if they think it's going to do really well, they might give us some marketing. Maybe they'll include us in their best books of the month. Maybe they'll do a Kindle Daily deal for us. I think you have a better chance of getting into some of those bigger promotions if they have more skin in the game too. If they take a lot of your copies, they want those copies to sell too.
And so how did you start this company? Did you raise capital? You make proceeds through royalties.
It was all I didn't take any outside funds. I'd say it was 90% my own money. And then my dad chipped in a little bit. And that was all it. I didn't have any outside investors because I'm the only full-time employee. I was the only full-time employee then. And our distributor takes a percentage of our sales. So we're not paying anyone salaries at this point. Our overhead costs were reasonable. Our biggest expenses are literally printing. I didn't start the company until I knew the industry fairly well. I knew the marketing side, I knew the publicity side, I knew the editorial side. I was confident enough that I knew the community enough that I could go after writers. I knew a lot of literary agents who could pitch me. The biggest issue I had was operations. I'd never run a publishing company. I didn't really know much about distribution. I didn't know much about finances because I was never on that side of it. So it was a bit of a crash course in sort of publishing economics a little bit. And I wish I'd maybe taken another year to learn that better before I started it. It's sort of one of those things like I ran before I could walk. But I was confident enough for better or worse that I could do it. I would not have done it had I not spent 10 years in the industry beforehand, because I was at least confident that even if I didn't know the operations, I knew enough of the other stuff that I could pick up on it pretty quickly.
Yeah. And let's talk about getting books into libraries. If somebody listening wants to get their book into a library, what would you recommend they do?
So having it available on Ingram is only a start. The issue there is that nobody knows to order it. So what we do, for example, we have our representatives pitch to Baker & Taylor. Baker & Taylor is the biggest distributor for libraries. So is Ingram. So we have people that actually go out to pitch the libraries. The best thing you can do if you're a self-published author is to contact your biggest library branches. If you're in, like, write letters to them, set up talks at your local libraries. Obviously, right now it's hard to set up talks, but maybe they have Zoom meetings, things along those lines. What you want to try to do is get into the larger library systems as opposed to the branches, the individual branches, because the larger systems order a lot. They might order 60 copies or 100 copies. And then a lot of people find out about that. That spreads a lot of word of mouth. But if you're doing it essentially almost a book at a time, you want to contact as many libraries as possible. What you also want to do is you want to have essentially a marketing and PR one pager. You want to get reviews. You want to get word of mouth. If you have some clips that you've written about, like we've been talking about, like positioning yourself as an expert, if you've written some blogs or articles, attach those to it. Essentially, don't just go to a library and say, please stock my book, but say, I'm so-and-so, I wrote a book about this, I'm an expert in the field, look at all these reviews and articles I've written, your patrons will be interested in this book. You want to give them a reason to buy your book, not just a reason to have, you know, them throw it in your email in the trash.
And when you said larger, it's good to get into larger library systems.
Yes.
Does that mean people shouldn't go to their local?
They absolutely should. I sort of look at book publicity and marketing distribution as sort of like baseball in a way, where there's singles, doubles, triples, and home runs. You want all of that. Going to your local library and getting them to order two copies it's a single. It's great, but it's not going to move a ton of copies. Getting into a larger library system might be a triple or a home run, because maybe they'll order 25 or 50 copies. And if you spend 5 hours a day getting singles, it's, you know, you look at the cost benefit analysis and it's not very high. You're going to be doing a lot of work for, like, you're probably going to be spending more money promoting your book than you are actually making off of your book. So what you want to try to do is you want to try to put yourself in a situation where you can ship the book in bulk. And part of that is getting to the larger systems, approaching local. I mean, you also want to approach your local bookstores. The biggest issue a self-published author has with local bookstores is that most self-published books are not returnable because they're print on demand. So a local bookstore doesn't want to take 20 copies of your book and then sell two of them, and then they're stuck with 18 copies they can't sell. So if you're going to approach a local bookstore, you want to tell them how you're going to sell all the copies. If you want them to take 20 copies, how are you going to sell those copies? Do you have a local network? Are your friends going to go pick up the book? Are you going to get maybe a profile in the local paper, an interview somewhere? Local bookstores can order a lot of copies. They just want to know that you have a way to drive people to the store.
That's great. And you said that you try to get it in Baker. You pitched to Baker and Taylor. Why not just Ingram, if Ingram carries library books?
This is Baker and Taylor. Their retail side has changed a lot recently. I'm not even sure if they do retail anymore. The difference is that Ingram essentially makes a book available. Baker and Taylor actually goes out and solicits books. So the difference is that in Ingram, the book is going to be available. But again, if you're a library in Peoria, Illinois, why are you going to order a debut novel from someone? You don't know who that is. You don't know who anything like that. However, like, if our sales reps go to Baker and Taylor and say, this is a great debut novel, we have reviews lined up in Publishers Weekly and Library Journal and a profile here, your patrons are going to hear about it. So that's the biggest difference and that's the big difference between having a book available and actually being able to drive people to want to read the book. If you live somewhere, all your friends and family and neighbors in your local community are going to want to read your book because they know you. But that's not going to sell a whole lot of books in the long run. How are you going to reach the people? If you live in New York, how are you going to reach people in California or Seattle or Boston or Washington, D.C.? You always need to look at sort of how are you going to reach beyond your local network? I think a lot of too many people just sort of like they have a Facebook page and they send an email to blast to their 30 closest friends and assume that's going to sell 50,000 copies, and it's not. Right. How are you going to drive people that don't know who you are to want to be able to buy your book?
Yeah, an interesting technique that I learned from one of my clients was she, you know, through social media, we have people all over the world. So ask your people to go and order it from their local bookstore, because then it's
absolutely
not you hyping it. And they're, you know, and she had people go in and say, hey, I'm going to do a book event.
Yeah.
And I'd rather have my people order it from you than from Amazon, because those are the magic words.
That's another thing, and that's actually a really important point, because you want essentially like what I call like a home base. So if you live in a community with a local bookstore, you want to make it your home base so that if anybody wants like an autographed copy of your book, they can order it directly from that bookstore. So you go to that bookstore and say like, obviously things are up in the air right now with the pandemic, but under normal circumstances, you might say, hey, I'm going to have an event with 20, 25 people. But then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on my website a link to your store. And I'm going to tell everybody on social media that if they want a signed copy of my book, they can order directly through you. That gives the store an incentive to not only sell your book, but to keep restocking your book too. And then word of mouth spreads. But independent bookstores, like they love feeling loved, as does everybody. And if you can show as a local author that you want to support them too, they're going to do a much better job of supporting you.
That's great. And let me ask you something to somebody who's listening and goes, libraries, who goes to libraries? Why would I care? What is the significance of getting in a library? Is it all word of mouth?
You'd be shocked at how much of our business we do through libraries. I would say maybe 35 to 50% of our print business is done through libraries. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of libraries in this country, and they all order books. So not only is it word of mouth, but libraries pay for those books. So if your book gets into the, you know, the Seattle Public Library, they're paying for every single copy they order. Maybe it's not going to be to the same extent. It's not as, libraries aren't as sexy as bookstores. To make it simple, they're not. But they buy a lot of books. We sell them a lot of books through Baker & Taylor and through Ingram. Maybe it's not necessarily a word of mouth as much. It's not, seeing your book in the stacks in the library is not as sexy as like posting an awesome picture on Instagram from your cool book launch party. But if 500 bookstores order your book, that's a lot more people than probably showed up to your book party. So they do order a lot of books, and they're definitely an avenue that I think probably a lot of self-published authors don't think about because they don't necessarily, again, the bookstore it just sounds cooler, but libraries should not be overlooked in terms of the numbers they can order and the word of mouth that could spread. Like every library also does reading series. So if you're a local author, see if you can do a reading series at your local bookstore. Again, if you're an expert in something, offer to do a seminar. They'll buy books. And then even if like people can't make it to that seminar, they'll watch it online and then order the book. There are so many ways you can work with your local library.
God, that's really great. But okay, and I know I seem abnormally fixated on Baker & Taylor, but can the average person, you said you have sales reps that go there. Can the average person just pitch?
Yes, the average person, I believe Baker & Taylor has, I want to say there's like a form on their website where essentially you can apply to get your book into sort of special promotions. To do that, though, I think you need to essentially have a bit of a publicity strategy. The idea is they want to know how you're going to drive people to buy your book. So what is your book about? Why are people going to come to it? Are you an expert in a certain area? Are you getting any reviews? Are you doing any publicity? Are you doing any talks or articles? I mean, if they're going to order X number of copies of your book, again, same thing, they want to make sure those books don't get returned.
Right.
So let them know. And that's, again, I think this is why people should start thinking about this months before the book comes out, because you want to be able to say this to them well in advance. You don't want the book to come out and then play catch. Like, you don't, when the gun goes off, you want to be running, not starting to run then.
But a library could still be interested in acquiring a book
absolutely
that isn't at the launch.
That's true. And this, I do think this is one of the benefits of self-publishing is that sort of publicity can happen at any time. In traditional publishing, as you know, the vast majority of publicity market.
Ooh, you went away.
What?
You moved and suddenly you've gone silent.
You're talking about me or?
Yes, I'm talking about you.
I went silent.
The connection got bad.
Oh, the connection got bad. I thought you meant like mysteriously emotionally sound or something like that. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So,
yes.
It used to be, publicity marketing was all built up within like 1 month of publication. So if you didn't get that publicity boost within a month, you were dead. That's different now. Like you said, now the books are available through Ingram. They can be ordered at any time. That said, I do think people still want to know, like, is this good book going to be buzzy? Are people going to be talking about it? And if you can sort of group a lot of publicity marketing hit together early on, that's probably going to create more buzz than if you sort of spread them out over 6 months. So you do want a bunch of stuff early on to really like build a lot of buzz, but then you do want to keep it going.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. If people want to get more of your wisdom, there's like a crazy sound. Don't laugh.
No. I was laughing. You saying people want to get more of my wisdom. I've never heard anybody say if people want more of my wisdom.
Get used to it. How can people find out more about you, about Polis Books, et cetera?
So if they want to find out about me, I'm at jasonpinter.com. That's my personal website. You can find out about my books, about me, upcoming stuff. For Polis Books, it's polisbooks.com, and that's polisbooks.com. And that you can find out about our books, what we have coming up, news, things along those lines. And I'm on social media at Jason Pinter, Twitter and Instagram. If anybody wants to teach me how to use TikTok or Snapchat, I'm all ears. But
yeah, me too. Let's do a Zoom lesson with the two of us. Well, Jason, thank you so much. This has been so informative.
True. Absolutely. I think it's good to finally catch up again after all this time. And then congrats on everything you're doing. Congrats on the new book.
Thank you. Thank you. Libraries, if you're listening, you can order it. Thank you so much, Jason.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Oh, and thank you all for listening.